The Gospel of Matthew, chapter 17, as we continue our studies in the miracles of Jesus, looking this morning at the coin in the fish's mouth. Matthew 17, beginning with verse 24. And when they came to Capernaum, those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax?" And he said, "Yes." And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? From their sons or from strangers?" And Peter said, "From strangers." Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are exempt. However, so that we do not offend them, go to the sea and throw in a hook and take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for you and me." The story, as A.B. Bruce once wrote, is a nut with a hard, dry shell, but a very sweet kernel. Another scholar, R.C. Trent, from that same century, declared that this is indeed a profound passage, even though it is somewhat imperfectly apprehended, and sometimes its meaning and significance is missed altogether. What's the point of this miracle? Is this merely something that Jesus was trying to evade, and so he turned to a miracle to pay something that he ordinarily should have done by himself? There are actually charismatics who think that this miracle proves that we should expect financial miracles like this because Jesus did it, so we ought to imitate him. Well, actually, as we unfold this, I think you're going to see that this is one of the most astonishing passages in all of the New Testament that underscores the deity of who Jesus of Nazareth was. There's a question here, as you see it, when he comes to a certain area. The Jews were looking for ways to ensnare him. We find this constantly. And so, instead of asking Jesus, they went to Peter and said, by way of a negative question, "Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax?" Now, what is this temple tax? Now, you remember earlier, Jesus had been confronted by the Pharisees and asked this question, "Is it proper to pay taxes to Caesar?" This is not a tax to the Roman. This is a tax to the temple. And we find all the way back in the Old Testament that the Israelites, in order to maintain the temple, had a 2 half-shekel tax imposed upon all males so that the upkeep of the temple could be maintained. It's interesting that the amount of money, Edersheim says, was quite significant, so much so that when the temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD, the amount of money inside the temple was profound in its amount. So that after the temple was destroyed, the Romans then imposed this tax on the Jews, even though there was no longer a temple, because there was so much revenue to be made. And so they asked this question. They're afraid to ask Jesus. And Peter, who, knowing Jesus, was a blameless individual, that he would not be shirking this duty, answered, "Well, of course he does." Now, notice what happens next. Before Peter has a chance to say something, Jesus asked him a question. What does this tell you? That we have an omniscient being here. He already knows that Peter has been asked. And so he poses a question to Peter. "Tell me this, Peter. Should the sons of the king be forced to pay subsidies to the king? Or is this something that strangers pay?" In other words, the king does not extract taxes from his family. He extracts them from his subjects. And Peter said, well, yeah, that's right. But, and here's where we have this qualification, so that we will not cause them to stumble. This word is literally scandalize them. Isn't it interesting that Jesus is now going to do something to avoid even the appearance of an impropriety? Because, you see, what would happen is this. He's not paying the temple tax because he has a disdain for the temple. After all, didn't this guy say one time, destroy this temple in 3 days, I will raise it up. Yeah, the temple took years to build. How are you going to do it in 3 days? But he was speaking, as you know, of his body. But he was accused of not having a high opinion. And you remember we looked at, when we examined the parable of the fig tree, that prior to that, he had gone in and cleansed the temple. Remember that on two different occasions, Jesus found the temple court flooded with marketeers. The court of the Gentiles had been overtaken as a bazaar. And so there were money changers, there were people selling livestock, and Jesus made a whip and drove them out and turned over their tables and said, my Father's house has been turned into a den of thieves. So he had already established a reputation among them that caused them to wonder about whether or not he was loyal. And so Jesus said, so that they may not be scandalized, we will pay the tax. Now here comes the miracle. Jesus knew that the tax collectors had already asked Peter this question, and so before Peter even has the chance to say something, Jesus now informs them. But now he says, go and take a fish hook, a line. Peter's going to become an angler. Now, not only, how did Peter fish? Well, we saw from last week that they fished with nets. But he didn't say, Peter, get in your boat, go out there and throw a net, and then go through them fish one at a time until you find one with a coin in his mouth. No, he says, throw your hook in, and the first fish you catch, you're going to find something astonishing. Not a half shekel, but a full shekel. Because Peter is going to be paying the tax for Jesus and Peter. And so, Jesus directed Peter's line to catch a fish that had been prepared by him with a coin in its mouth. Now, that's not common. You do remember all the way back in the book of Jonah, the famous story of Jonah and the whale, although it really isn't a whale, that Jonah was caught in a storm and he told the sailors that the storm is my fault, so the only way we're going to get you out of it, you've got to throw me overboard. And the text says, and God had appointed, and that the word means he had prepared this thing, this huge fish of some sort swallowed Jonah whole. And Jonah was able to remain alive in its stomach for 3 days. A specially prepared fish is now going to have a coin in its mouth. Isn't that amazing? This is something that only God can do. The other thing that is so astonishing about this miracle is that Jesus is identifying himself as royalty. He's not one of the subjects of the king. He is the son. It is a claim to equality. You do remember that the charge upon which Jesus was accused of blasphemy was this. He claims to be the Son of God, thereby making himself equal with God. And for that reason, the Jews sought to kill him. And so here we have one of these indirect. You know, people sometimes say, I never read in the Bible where it says Jesus is God. No, not like that, we don't. But we see the indications, the affirmations of his deity in his acts. What can he do that is so astonishing that only God can do this? Herman Ridderbos is a noted Dutch New Testament theologian who wrote a magnificent commentary on this very book of the Bible. He says the miracle is only reported in the Gospel of Matthew. It is characteristic of this stage of Jesus' ministry that it happens away from the crowd. Nobody saw this miracle. The only people that are aware of it are Jesus and Peter. Peter needed a demonstration of his Lord's greatness. You remember once in an outburst of enthusiasm, he had confessed that Jesus is the Son of God, but he still had much to learn. He needed a far deeper understanding of Christ's impending sufferings and death that would not only come upon him, but would actually be the result of God's sovereign providence. It's interesting. Here, Peter witnesses this amazing miracle. And yet, when you read his own writings, 1 and 2 Peter, he doesn't mention it by name. But he does say, we were witnesses to his glory, the glory of the only begotten, the witness of the transfiguration. Peter was there. And Peter had witnessed the miracles. But he never alludes to this one. You would think that had you and I been the beneficiaries of that, we'd have told everybody we could have talked. I remember the time Jesus had me catch a fish with a coin in his mouth and he told me it would happen. Why? Because the apostles were not, like we are so often, consumed with our experiences. It's interesting. You oftentimes hear people talk about Jesus and how they have had this miraculous experience of the new birth, which is good. I don't know if you've ever been in churches where they have testimony meetings. I grew up in churches like that. Yeah, testimony. And somebody would stand up and give a testimony about how they were converted from a life of shame and drunkenness or whatever, and they are a transformed person. And sometimes you hear people say things like this. We sing it in that hymn. He lives, he lives, he lives. You're asking how I know he lives. He lives within my heart. What if you don't exist? Does he still live? Because what the apostles were concerned with was testifying to the historicity of a person, Jesus of Nazareth. And that's why it's so important when we do confess the Apostles' Creed that mention is made that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate. He's a historical figure. Jesus is a historical figure. And what they're concerned with is what did this person do? Based upon that, we do have experiences, but the experiences are not what preoccupy them. The witness is what preoccupies them. I have discovered something as I grow older, and I find myself drawn to the Gospels more and more because I want to know more and more clearly the person of Christ. It's interesting if you study history, and I was a history major along with majoring in philosophy, that you study historical figures. And I like to read biographies. I'm reading one now on Oliver Cromwell, the Lord Protector, the great Puritan who, in the interlude between the monarchy, ruled England. And prior to that, I read the life of Winston Churchill, or one of them. And I'm just fascinated by reading them. And you get to know them. And you come to admire them. But the thing about it is, when you come to the Gospels, you're looking at the person of Jesus, who is a historical figure who still calls sinners to himself, who still extends out the call, come unto me, all you who are weary laden. And when weary laden sinners call upon the name of Jesus, they're calling upon the name of this Jesus, who is able to do above and beyond all that we ask or say. And so I beseech you this morning to call upon the Lord Jesus, and he will come. He has promised he will do everything to save sinners.